It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new season of Wisconsin Life debuts tonight on public television. We'll talk to the show's host and head producer about what to expect this time around. First, Attorney General Brad Schimel is requiring employees of the State Department of Justice to sign non-disclosure agreements. Staffers at the DOJ were informed of that change last month. The change comes at a time when many governmental agencies are considering similar moves, the most high-profile example being in the Trump administration. Our next guest is here to talk about reasons behind the move and the reactions so far. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We'll talk about these NDAs, non-disclosure agreements. What do we know so far?
So the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel was the first to report on this, and they reported it out this morning that they obtained the document that they say was circulated on August 10th to a number of DOJ employees who hadn't yet signed this document. So it had been circulating prior to that and had been signed by a number of people. And basically what it does is it instructs DOJ employees not to share any of the confidential information that they encounter as a part of their state work. So obviously the DOJ has a number of responsibilities in a number of departments, but some of that confidential information can range from, you know, criminal justice records to personal health information and intellectual property. So there's kind of a wealth of confidential information there that they have access to, and the DOJ wants to keep them from sharing that.
And what's the duration? Is this just while they're on the job, or now and forever, or somewhere in between?
So it's now and forever. It says you won't disclose this information while you're a state employee, and you won't disclose it if you complete your employment with the state and move on to other employment. And I think that that's a tenet that has been particularly disturbing to some of the critics of this proposal.
Right. What are critics of this worried about? What are they saying?
Well, they're saying essentially that this sort of flies in the face of government transparency, that it could potentially have a chilling effect on whistleblowers for the State Department of Justice, and just generally kind of sends a bad message about government workers being able to share information that they're doing on behalf of the public.
What has the Department of Justice said about why they have these, why they're putting these into place?
So the Department of Justice hasn't gotten back to me. I want to be clear on that. I reached out to them for a comment earlier, and I haven't heard back yet. But they did speak with the Journal Sentinel, and the Journal Sentinel reported that the DOJ said that this is simply a response to an employee previously sharing some confidential information on social media. So they wanted to have a department-wide policy that would make sure that employees were in compliance with not sharing this type of information in the future, and that this has nothing to do with any sort of political motivation. Of course, the Attorney General is running for another term in office right now, and that's something people have been throwing around, that maybe he doesn't want negative political stories out there about him and that this would discourage that. The DOJ said that has nothing to do with it, and they also said that they don't believe that the document would do anything to discourage whistleblowers from coming forward if they see any wrongdoing within the department.
Talking to Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, looking at information out today about the state's Department of Justice requiring employees to sign these non-disclosure agreements, saying they can't reveal confidential information they have from that agency now or in the future, even after they're working for the agency. Laurel, it seems like the key point, the sticking point here is, what kind of confidential information are we talking about? Some of the things you referenced earlier, or say personal information about a crime victim, probably most people would agree, okay, we don't want them talking about that. But there's other information that, as you're saying, with concerns about whistleblowers, that might be a problem. Do we know how this document defines confidential information?
So the document itself mentions some of that information that I outlined before, like the protected health information or intellectual property, or as you mentioned, criminal justice information. So it does lay that out to make that clear to employees. I think some of the concern about this is coming from people who say, well, the nature of a whistleblower is that they take confidential information, they take information that they've worked with and have expertise in, and that they bring it forward if they think something untoward is going on. But it is interesting to note, I spoke with a UW professor emeritus this morning who taught in the law and political science departments, as well as the journalism department, actually. And he said that as long as this document deals entirely with confidential information, if it's focused, it doesn't violate the First Amendment rights of the employees at the DOJ. And if there's a state whistleblower law that protects them in cases of whistleblowing, then everything looks pretty good here. It shouldn't be considered illegal or anything.
Do we know if other state agencies do similar things?
We don't. I know that that's a question that some reporters have been asking today, whether this is sort of an administration-wide policy that expands to other departments other than DOJ. And I don't believe we have an answer on that yet, but we do know that the state has a law that applies to all departments that protects whistleblowers. They can't be retaliated against if they disclose information about lawbreaking or abuses of power. They just have to meet a couple requirements before they can make that public disclosure.
Have any other government officials, Republican or Democrat, spoken out that you've seen so far?
Yeah. So we heard from Governor Walker this morning. Reporters asked him what he thought about this and whether anyone in his office, in the governor's office, has to sign a similar document. And he said that no one in the governor's office has to sign an NDA, as they're called. They just have to sign off on having taken an ethics course.
And as you mentioned, this is election season. Has anyone specifically tried to make this an election issue one way or another?
Mm-hmm. So the state Democratic Party put out a statement this morning that says that this particular move is sort of exemplary of a track record that Attorney General Schimmel has had that has worked against open government, they contend, in the past. They said that he hasn't been as transparent as he could have been about travels to speak at certain professional conferences that people wanted more information about. He also worked a few years ago, some people might remember, to keep some training videos private that he created when he was a prosecutor. The state Supreme Court actually ruled with Schimmel in that case that it was appropriate to keep them private. But the state Democratic Party is saying that we need more transparency, not less, and this is a negative example of that.
And Laurel, while we've got you, I didn't give you a heads up. I was going to ask you about this. Just wanted to get your thoughts. Word that Governor Walker is calling the state Senate, hoping they can come back into session, looking at this incentive package for Kimberly Clark. This isn't something we see every day in the off season for the legislature.
No. We have had in recent months the legislature coming back unexpectedly, I think a little bit more than normal. They came back for the special elections discussion earlier this year. They've come back on school safety. But the Kimberly Clark incentive package, which is modeled after the Foxconn incentive package, is something that lawmakers have been talking about for several months now. And Kimberly Clark has come up with a September 30th deadline for the state about whether they're going to offer this package to the company. So Governor Walker's pushing lawmakers to come back and to consider it. It's already passed the state assembly. That's behind us, but the state Senate still would need to pass it.
And as I understand it, check me if I'm wrong here, Laurel, the assembly passed a version. The easy thing would be if the Senate passed exactly what the assembly passed. Mm-hmm. Some Republicans aren't on board, though. If the Senate does something different than, if I understand my Wisconsin civics, we'd have to bring the assembly back to agree with them?
That is right, Rob. So we really don't know what's going to happen here. All of the leaders in the state legislature have been working closely with their members. We're getting updates as the day moves on about where members stand on this legislation, particularly in the Senate, whether they support it or not. We haven't heard from a fair number of them. So it's unclear whether they're going to have the support necessary to pass this in the Senate, whether that's the same version as the assembly or a slightly altered version. And obviously, the clock is ticking on that September 30th deadline.
And as we mentioned earlier with the attorney general issue, it's election season. Hypothetically, senators might be looking over their shoulder one way or the other. They could be criticized for voting for or against this thing.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very contentious political issue in that it is modeled after the Foxconn incentive package, which, as I'm sure people know, has been very polarizing. So taking another vote on a similar package really cements political positions on this type of thing, on giving incentives to keep private companies in Wisconsin. It would save about 600 jobs. So I think lawmakers are having to weigh where they stand on this issue in a challenging time for them, for sure.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today on both of these topics.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, State Capitol Reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us today to talk about State Department of Justice employees being required to sign non-disclosure agreements. Also, this breaking news that Governor Walker asking the state Senate to come back into session to consider a Kimberly-Clark incentive package. A new season of Wisconsin Life debuts tonight on public television. For 5 years, the show has been traveling the state to profile the people and traditions that make Wisconsin unique. This season will meet motorcycle riders in Pine Bluff, an architect channeling Frank Lloyd Wright, and many others. You can catch the season premiere tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Television and at 7:30 on PBS in Milwaukee. We'll get a preview now with series producer Kelly Saran and Angela Fitzgerald, the host of Wisconsin Life. Angela, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Kelly, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's get a taste of what we can expect from this new season. Angela, give us a couple of the highlights, and we'll dig deeper into them later.
Well, you'll see one of the highlights on air tonight. We went to the Crandon International Raceway, and so I got to experience what it feels like to drive in a race truck. it's a very, very exciting experience, I'll say that.
All right. And can you, let's step back, Kelly. What makes a story a Wisconsin Life kind of story?
You know, a Wisconsin Life story really is people who are kind of doing amazing things, people who have something to share around our state, people who are really passionate. It could even be groups of people as well. We usually get viewer submissions, and I feel like the more you send us, there are stories to be told around our state, and it's amazing. It surprises me every time we do a story.
And Angela, I'm a little jealous. I mean, I get to talk to people around Wisconsin
yes.
all the time, here in this studio or in that studio over there. How much fun is it to actually get out around the state and meet people and doing cool stuff?
I mean, it's pretty exciting. I do like meeting people in general. So to be able to travel around a state that, I mean, I've gone to some parts of Wisconsin, but Wisconsin Life has exposed me to much more of the state than I've traveled on my own. So everyone that we've met is great. And I love the passion they have about their areas.
And what have you learned about Wisconsin this time around that's new to you?
Wow. So like I mentioned the racetrack again. Well, we have an internationally renowned racetrack that I was unaware of. We have a pretty reputable caving area that different youth groups and different environmental groups visit pretty often. Yeah, those are the two that most immediately come to mind.
And I think it's funny, too, because we usually put Angela into situations she's never been in. Like this year, we went canoeing on the Brule State River Rapids.
True.
So we're getting her out there. We're getting her meeting people. There's so many passionate groups, too. And what's exciting, too, is that with the host, you get to explore location, but you also get to tell people stories. So it's really an intimate experience of Wisconsin.
So they're putting you in scary situations?
Well, I wouldn't say scary. It's unexpected.
Okay, that sounds better. Well, I want to get a taste of some of the show here. I want to start with some unique music you found this season from an instrument called a handpan being made by Jenny Robinson of Madison. Here's a listen.
Well, a handpan is two sheets of steel that have been hardened in some way, either by heat treatment or hammering. It has notes on the top that are played with the hands. The bottom is like a resonating cavity. It's a very unique sounding instrument. The handpan originated in the year 2000. It was developed by two steel pan tuners in Switzerland.
Does it look as cool as it sounds, the handpan, Angela?
Yes, and that music just sounded so relaxing just then.
Yeah, pretty cool. Yeah, and that's a cool topic because I think of musical instrument invention as something that happened in the old days way back when. Kelly, it's happening now and it's happening in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's happening right in Madison. And it's funny about the handpan, too, is that she's one of only two female handpan makers in the nation. So she constructs these, and really what you see later on in this piece, too, is how she kind of fine-tunes them. And it's a work of art in itself, and a lot of reject handpans as well, which is kind of interesting, so you kind of get to see the reject pile there, but it's fascinating. And there are musicians who are creating things around the state that we get to see this season.
And when we hear about now farmers markets, we usually think of a weekly market in a set location. Let's give another taste of the show now. You found a mobile farmers market run by an Oneida farmer named Dan Cornelius. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say.
For Dan Cornelius, food has always been an important influence in his life. As a member of the Oneida Nation, Dan developed a strong connection with Native American food and culture.
You know, for me, of why I was drawn to food and to agriculture is, you know, food is at the core of life, of survival. It touches on all aspects of life.
It was that interest that led Dan to realize there was an opportunity for Native Americans in Wisconsin to honor their agricultural history and sell their goods.
So, Dan, a lot of other smaller scale farmers in Wisconsin getting some inspiration from the past and their culture here. Talk a little more about Dan's story, Kelly.
So Dan is really about the preservation of seeds and foods in the culture. And it's so interesting. He has his own little plot of land. And then, like it mentions, he kind of travels around in this mobile farmers market. Mm-hmm. It's an education as well as kind of supplying people with food as well. And what's interesting, too, is we get to meet people, you know, all over the state. We met tortilla makers. We also met more conventional farmers, a crop duster. But, you know, Dan's story really touches on a farmer with a purpose. He's doing it for a reason.
Angela, do you get to do some tastings on the way here?
Well, for Dan, no. I did not get to taste his food, unfortunately. But I love the accessibility that he provides through his market to Native American foods for those who don't have that access.
That's a unique story. This is, once again, and this happens to me all the time with Wisconsin Life, no idea. I didn't know this was out here. And I'm in a position where I should. Is it fun finding these hidden gems?
It is. It's fun finding them, but also being able to share them with others. Because as Wisconsiners, we also can be unaware of what our state has, what it possesses. And so to experience that richness and be able to share that with others is awesome.
We're talking about Wisconsin Life with host Angela Fitzgerald and Kelly Saran, series producer for Wisconsin Life, checking out their new season. Well, you mentioned, we got to listen to this one because you mentioned it. You visited the Crandon International Raceway. This is in northeastern Wisconsin. Here's a little listen to that.
Off-road racing is someplace where you're going to come and you're going to see dirt fly, you're going to see mud fly, you're going to see people going over jumps 150, 200 feet, flying through the air with 5,000 pound pickup. You're going to see wrecks. They're going to bump, and it's a little bit rougher. It's just a little bit rougher racing, which you're used to, but good racing. The kids love it.
Powerful motors, high-flying jumps, and top speeds. Who couldn't resist a trip around the track?
Hey, Adam.
Hello.
So what should we expect from today's race?
High speed and a lot of fun. Hang on tight.
Slide right on in.
Okay.
All right, we didn't have the visual there. You actually got in one of these high-speed trucks?
Yes, I got into a high-speed truck, and they don't have doors. You have to slide in through the window to get into the truck, and we went around the track. I don't even remember how many times.
It was many. And that was one where I said, Angela, we're going to a racetrack. I didn't give her too many details. Uh-oh, and then no. I said, guess what? You're hopping in.
So. Okay. That sounds scary. Were they going at full speed here?
They were going at full speed. And I think we all have different ideas of what it means to be on a racetrack and to be in a race car. I'm thinking like Indy 500, paved roads, like a regular car. This is off-road trucks with big wheels, dirt flying everywhere. It was an exciting experience.
And they mentioned really long jumps. Did you get to go on any of those?
I went on several of those.
Oh, you'll see that on the show. You'll
okay.
see.
It felt like a roller coaster.
Hey, do you remember when I was envious of you a little while ago?
Not anymore.
No, that sounds a little scary. So, but this, Kelly, is another unique piece of Wisconsin.
Man, it is. And it's so interesting because we really traveled all over the state kind of seeing places that I didn't even know existed. And a lot of them we got from viewer submissions as well. People telling us, hey, this is in our community. This is something you should definitely check out. And we head out there. We see if it's a good fit. And then we get Angela there exploring it and enjoying the people who love what they do.
And Angela, you're going to keep doing this. You're not going to leave us to take up a life on off-track truck racing, are you?
I don't plan to.
Okay. And Kelly, we should leave it with an invite to people. You're always looking for submissions, right? How can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so you can visit our website, wisconsinlife.org. Otherwise, you can directly email us at wisconsinlife@wpt.org. And like I said, we're always, if you're doing something or you know somebody who's doing something really extraordinary, you know a place you want to share with us, please send it. And we'll check it out.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Angela Fitzgerald is the host of Wisconsin Life, and Kelly Saran is the series producer. The show's sixth season debuts tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Television and 7:30 on PBS in Milwaukee. Whether or not to have kids is one of the biggest decisions people can make. You can buy a house and you can sell it. You can get married, you can get a divorce. But with kids, there's really no return policy. Some people know they want kids, some people know they don't, but there are a lot of people in the middle, and it can be hard to weigh the pros and cons when you can't really know what you're getting into. If that's you, good news. There's some help out there in making that big decision. Hannah Seligson is a New York City-based journalist who writes about culture, politics, and gender, among other things. She's the author of the recent New York Times article, Scared to Be a Parent. Hannah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Merle Bamaderi is a clinical social worker and the author of the book, The Baby Decision, How to Make the Most Important Choice of Your Life. She also runs a day-long workshop in Massachusetts to help potential parents work through their decision. Merle, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Hannah, why did you want to take a closer look into this zone of people, the people on the fence about having kids and what goes into that decision?
Because this was me. For 6 years, my husband and I debated whether to have a child. Spoiler alert, I did have a child. She's 8 months today, and I'm not returning her. But it was, I mean, in all seriousness, it was a very wrenching, painful process. And I wish I had known about these resources. I myself did not use Merle's book or any of the other resources I talk about in the article. I wish I had known about them. And I think the conventional wisdom in society is that if you don't know, then that means you shouldn't have children. And what I think that Merle and a lot of the other people in this space are challenging is that that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have children and that it's a much more complicated, introspective process than just yes or no. And people have to go through a series of questions and some real soul searching to decide.
And Merle, Hannah was not alone. A lot of people are in this maybe zone, right?
Yes, a lot of people are in the maybe zone. And one of the biggest problems is that they think that they need to be pretty sure in either direction. What I tell people is it makes sense to be scared about this decision. The word decide comes from a Latin root, which means to cut away from. So every decision involves loss. So when people say, what's the matter with us? Why can't we decide? Once you decide to be child-free, you're giving up all the joys that parenthood would bring. Once you decide to have a child, you're looking at a lot of giving up quiet, meditation, control, spontaneity. It makes sense to be scared. So people often have a leaning, and they're even afraid to say it because they think they're flip-flopping. So I say 60-40 is a decision. When 60-40 you're leaning one way and 40 the other way, that is the beginning of a decision. People shouldn't panic. Now, you're not going to call it a decision until it evolves into 70-30 or 80-20 by doing workshops, reading, talking to people, and you know, and so on. But people are terrified of making this decision because they think that they're going to lose everything about the other choice. So I ask people to figure out which decision do you think you'll regret least because you're going to lose something either way. And that really helps people to think it through. And there's also the issue that if you decide to have a child, knowing that you want some of the freedom of being child-free, you can plan. So instead of sweeping the doubts under the rug, you can say, how can I steal a little bit of what I really value from the other side? And for instance, I do in my workshop an empty chair technique in which I have someone speak between the part of themselves that is absolutely certain, I want a child, and in the other chair they speak and say, are you crazy? We're definitely going to be child-free. And what happens back and forth is so interesting. Once people make a decision, they think they're going to sweep the other thing under the rug. And I say, don't do that, because everything that you wanted about the other choice is going to give you the clues to how you can be happy as a child-free person but still have some sense of family and nurturance and vice versa. So rather than just saying, oh, my God, I have to give everything up here, there's, okay, What little pieces can I add? So child-free people, how can I, you know, maybe nurture my nieces and nephews? And for people who are going to be parents, what absolutely matters to me most that I think I'm giving up? Meditation, exercise, travel, whatever. So I start making the decision more fluid for people when they don't feel like they have to absolutely know. It doesn't have to light up in neon.
And Hannah, I think you mentioned in your reporting that we have kind of a new group, or not completely new, but a growing group of people who wait longer to have kids. This was me, actually, 15, 16 years ago. And so they have a lot of experience having a grown-up life without kids. Is that weighing on this decision, Hannah, among the people you talk to?
Yes. And so I think here, you know, there are a lot of internal and external factors. So, yes, people have it just takes longer to reach the milestones of adulthood. People get married later. They reach a financial security later. All of these things happen sometimes well into one's 30s. And so there is just a period where you are on your own. And so I think the transition into parenthood can be more jarring, and there's just more time also to consider it. But one thing that I did find very interesting about the approach that a number of these programs take is that it isn't supposed to be an external process, at least initially, that you're supposed to look internally and really not talk about whether you should have children or talk about that with other people, you know, outside of the group of people that you're working with, or if you're working one-on-one with a counselor, and that you're supposed to sort of tune out things like money and societal pressure and family pressure. And, you know, sort of in retrospect, I can see how that would have been very helpful to sort of just find your intuition about it. On the other hand, I'll be on the other side. I do have to say that, you know, things like biology and finances do factor in. So it's reporting it and living it myself, I do see it as this very complicated alchemy of both this internal and external process.
Yeah, Merle, I want to talk about maybe the social pressures and how, if it's possible to tune them out, what your parents want, what your friends and colleagues and generation mates want. Is it really possible to take out that kind of static in making this decision for ourselves?
I don't think it is. I think what is important is that you do give yourself some time when you're asking what you want. There's also the pressure from your partner. If your partner wants something else, that can be such a distraction. So sometimes when people feel they could go either way, they just let their partner decide. And that is a very, very bad way of doing things, because you can't be fully on board if you haven't thought through what appeals to you and doesn't appeal to you about both choices. So when I do my workshops, we do start in the morning making a list of the stereotypes of people who are child-free, the stereotypes of parenting, why people make those choices. And we talk a lot about pressures. So I guess one really important thing to say is that there are a lot of people, unfortunately, including mental health professionals, who think that all mentally healthy people have children, and that the only people who choose to be child-free are people who had a terrible childhood, or there's something else that doesn't function right in their personality. This is absolutely not true. There are many super mentally healthy people who have the courage to choose to be child-free and the courage to pursue things like environmental or political causes or right or art and not start a family so that they can do their best. So it doesn't, a lot of people are dealing with that pressure. So their friends and their brothers and sisters want them to have children that they can play with and all be nieces and friends together. Parents, of course, want grandchildren. And it is a lot of people who are leaning towards child-free are terrified to tell their parents that they're thinking about being child-free. So I would say in every workshop I do, we spend at least half an hour on communicating with family if you are choosing to be child-free.
And Hannah, does it look to you like it's a common situation as you talk to professionals that it's the we often have the one partner who does want kids, the other one who doesn't, which can be a relationship deal breaker?
Yeah, in the reporting that I did for this, which was a small sample size, that wasn't necessarily the dynamic. But what I wanted to add, too, is that I think society and all parents who are pressuring their children to have kids also need to sort of look at the increased burden that it is both financially and just professionally to have children now. We don't have paid leave. We don't have great childcare policies and resources in this country. And so I think that's also factoring into a lot of people's decisions. And I'd be interested to hear from Merle whether she sees that as well in her group, that just people are also feeling the weight of the lack of support in society.
Yeah, Merle, do you see that?
Oh, I do see that. And, you know, it's so interesting how many people who have worked for American companies but in Europe have had this wonderful time combining career and parenthood. And then they're transferred back to the United States and they suddenly discover this life is unlivable. Childcare is too expensive. There's no paid maternity leave. How are we going to do this? And so we are the only industrialized nation that doesn't provide excellent support for new parents. So that is a major issue. And there's also, with the millennial generation, and Hannah's written a number of books about this, with taking loans for more and more expensive tuition, trying to pay off those loans, trying to get jobs when the millennials came out of school, the job market wasn't very good. So they have all of the financial pressures. Can we afford this? Plus, we have all the environmental concerns. What kind of world is this to bring a child into? And so there are many, many things that are weighing on decision makers in 2018 that were not when I first started doing this work in the 1980s.
We're talking about the process of deciding to have kids or not with Merle Bombadieri, a clinical social worker and author of the book The Baby Decision, and Hannah Seligson, a journalist who recently covered this issue for The New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Was this you? Have you had a point in your life where you're trying to decide whether or not to have kids? You see pros and cons on both sides. How did you make that decision? How are you, if you're there now, how are you trying to make that decision? What are your hopes? What are your fears as you think this through? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with journalist Hannah Seligson and Merle Bombadieri, clinical social worker and author, talking about deciding whether or not to have children and some of the fears and decisions that come along with that. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in the midst of trying to make up your mind whether or not to have kids? Or did you go through this process? What did you decide? How did you decide? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Heather is with us in Madison. Heather, hello.
Oh, hey, hi. Nice to talk to you guys. So I have a slightly different perspective on this. I'm going to caveat this, that I'm 44 years old, and my oldest is 21, and my youngest is 15. So I would just like to flip the conversation on its head, being that I have friends that have little tiny children that are the same age as I am, and I'm looking at them going into their 60s when their kids are going to be my kids' age. And I feel like now that, you know, since I had my kids right after I finished college, I still have 20 years of like, duty-free adulting ahead of me before, you know, I feel like I'm going to be elderly. So,
Heather, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your experience. Merle, things have changed now that people, more and more people aren't like Heather, not having kids that young.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that I would imagine that some of Heather's friends went through years of infertility and were actually trying. If they're becoming parents in their 40s, they might have started at 31 or even 29 and been through many, many years of infertility and would have preferred to start sooner. There are also the people who didn't find a partner as early as they wanted to, or in order to get established in their career, they weren't able to start when they wanted to. So not everybody that has kids in their 40s really had that as the first choice. So one of the things that they say is, yes, it's hard to start now. We're older. We can't run up and down football fields. But we would rather be older parents than miss out entirely. And we also find that older parents have a lot of perspective. They do very well with being mixed with younger generation parents. They have a lot of patience and perspective. And to be an older parent back in the 50s or 60s meant that you had no idea what young children or teenagers were doing. Now our society is a lot more integrated. And so people who are in their 40s are able to get down on floors. They're more physically fit. They want to be playful. They're playful in their own weekends and travel even before they have a child. So, yes, you have the great advantage that you've got these years ahead when you're in excellent health. And that's a great, great advantage. But not everybody is able to do that. And also, I don't think I mentioned, some people come from very difficult childhoods. And by the time they've had enough therapy to both be able to find a partner who would be a good parent and for them to feel ready to parent, they may be in their 40s, even though they wished they had started in their 30s.
Thanks a lot for that call, Heather. Go ahead, Hannah.
Oh, and if you just also, if you look, just to piggyback on what Merle said, if you look at the research on millennials, they have a mentality, and I think this can go both ways, that they really want to have their ducks in a row before they get married and before they have children. And, you know, you could ask, well, what does that mean? When are you ever sort of ready? And I heard from, you know, some of the women I interviewed for the piece that said, you know, well, I felt like I had to have a house of a certain size. And, you know, it can be a way of just delaying a decision. But I think ultimately it is a very prudent mentality because they want to be prepared. They want to be ready and economically and professionally secure before they take on such a big decision and responsibility as having a child.
We'll go now to Dan with us in Lake Mills. Dan, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I wanted to ask if you ever ask people about introversion versus extroversion, because for me, I have four kids ranging from 10 months to 17 years old. And my life is not my own. Like,
wow,
from 5 a.m. until 10 p.m. every day, I'm just going at it. I don't have, you know, I'm not on the volleyball team. I'm not on the baseball team. I don't have a favorite show. It's just, I'm just working the grind. And there's, like, awesome joys to it. But I just think that that would be one consideration. And I often, like, wonder, like, what about having one child as, like, the compromise and, like, how popular is that these days? Because, you know, you can't replace having a child. Like, there's, like, the joy and like, you know, watching someone develop speech and the movement. There's just no substitution for that.
But I'm going to jump in, Dan, because you gave us a lot to talk about there. First, Merle, do you see this, the introvert thing that Dan brought up? You know, I'm kind of an introvert myself. I do like to have that downtime as a parent. Yeah, you give up some of that. Is that a concern people have?
It is a concern that people have. I do believe it's true that people who are strong introverts are a little more likely to choose to be child-free, but there are also introvert parents who are very happy to be parents. They might have just one child to be more one-on-one, or they might really want to plan ahead to have their quiet time, reflective time, meditation time, and all of that kind of thing. I do want to jump in about the one child because that's very important. One of the things that I say in my workshop is you do not have to decide between zero and two. How can you, if you're terrified and not sure you're going to want one child, think that if you have one, you have to have another so the child won't be unhappy or spoiled? Research shows that one-child families, the children are very mentally healthy. They do extremely well, and they are also high achievers. A one-child family is a great way for a two-career couple to be less tied down for fewer years, to be able to experience the best of both worlds. And unfortunately, there are many people who would like to have two or three kids who are having only one, either because of the environment or because of the factors Hannah was talking about, that they simply can't afford to have more than one, and they're not even sure they can have that one.
And Hannah, in looking at this this kind of industry of helping people decide, was it always, should we have a kid? Or are some people out there wondering, should we have another kid as they seek advice?
Yes, I've heard that. And I do think Merle's right that people feel like if they've won, they need to have two. But also, you know, the research shows that particularly for women, one child is sort of the magic number where you can keep your career. You can sort of have it all. That is the sweet spot. And it's really with the second child that the wheels fall off and that it's harder to balance work and life and everything. So, you know, it just, I think it goes to the kind of nature of this decision that everything is seen in such extreme terms. It's either two children or zero children, or it's either you know or you don't know. And there's just a lot of gray area, much more fluidity in this conversation and decision complexion.
And Merle, I wanted to get into that point that Hannah just made as we start to wrap up, the idea that you either know or you don't know. Well, clearly there is the possibility of not knowing, but arriving at a decision.
Okay. I think that maybe there is, I really don't know percentages, but maybe 25% of people of childbearing age know that they do want to have kids, and 25% know that they don't. But it's a big 50% who see good things about both. And that's really wisdom because, as I said, decide means cut away from. You're going to lose a lot, whichever you decide. And it makes sense to take time with this. So people who are usually very fast decision makers may be trashing themselves or their partner, why haven't we decided sooner? But there's no harder decision. If I ask you, do you want this job? You have to do it for 20 years. You don't get paid for it. It's 24/7. It makes sense to take time and slow down and get it sorted out.
In our last few minutes, Hannah, can I ask about your personal story? You did make this decision. You have an 8-month-old, I think you said. Was there one factor that finally nudged you in that direction?
Yes, and I was going to talk about that. If there was one factor, it was definitely age, the sort of biological clock. I'm 36. I turned 35 last summer, and I felt like, all the research showed that it was time, and so I think I needed that push. But I wouldn't say that was the one definite factor that pushed me, but if I had to sort of isolate something. My friend also said something very funny to me, which I think is true. She said, Hannah, just have the child so you can stop angsting about it. And there is truth to that, but I also will just say one thing, too, that I think anyone who says that there's not mixed feelings on either side, once you have a child or you don't have a child, you're always going to feel like maybe you're missing out on something, and that's just normal.
That's a good place to leave it. Thanks to both of our guests, Hannah Seligson, journalist and author, and Merle Bombadieri, clinical social worker, author of the book The Baby Decision. They join us to talk about the fears people have of becoming parents and the people who have a tough time deciding one way or the other and how people choose, the factors they weigh, what goes into the biggest decision that a person can make. The Milwaukee Brewers are still in a tight race for first place after a big win yesterday. Central Time producer Bill Martins is excited. Hey, Bill.
Oh, my gosh, Rob. This is such a great time to be a Brewers fan. They are smoking hot right now. So they had a big series this past week, 3-game set with the first place Chicago Cubs at Wrigley, and the Cubs had a 2-game lead going into the series. It was four games about a week ago, but the Brewers have been winning a lot of games. The Cubs have been on the skids a little bit, so 2 games going into the series. Brewers took Game 1, Cubs took Game 2, so still 2 games going into last night's game. Now, a Cubs win probably would have
sealed the deal for them.
Yeah, I think so. I probably would. I would say that. But the Brewers wound up winning the game, so now they're right on the Cubs' keisters now with just 1 back, and there's about 15 games left. They can make up that ground, and if they can't, which would be unfortunate, the odds makers still give them a 98.5% chance of making the postseason.
Yeah, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had a very complicated breakdown of the different scenarios here. The gist is, if they can keep winning a good half or most of their games, they're probably going to be in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, if the Brewers just take care of business and win their games, they're going to be fine.
You are, even for Bill Martins, unusually animated on this.
Wow, so, really?
Yeah, so
wow.
you can sense the excitement, people.
It was that Red Bull in the office that I had.
Nobody drank that. Nobody drank that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.